We're here with composer Scott Wolschlager, who has done amazing, amazing works. I mean, I love this quote that characterizes you as, let me find it here, a mix between Martin Feldman meets Thelonious Monk meets H.P. Lovecraft. I love that description of your work. We're here to talk about this album, which I've actually got here. It's called Between Breath, which is one of the tracks on the CD. I wonder if you can talk about first about the collaboration, all the people that are performing your music on this recording.
The record has works that were written on and off for about 7 year period. They're all commissioned compositions by the performers that are featured on the album. So you're hearing sort of expert performances of the pieces by the people they were written for and who have been playing these pieces for many years. The pieces themselves don't have much in common with each other than I wrote them all. And there's a lot of similarities, I think, between the string writing in my music. And oddly enough, I found, Between Breath, the title track, uses trombone and piano. And the song that is on the album, Any Way Where Threads Go, It All Goes Well, uses pitch pipes, which is a basically, it's a educational instrument for kids to learn how to tune their instruments, but the singer blows through it and making sort of like a tone cluster with it. And I found that, oh, like the pitch pipe is kind of like a very, very bizarre wind instrument, and we could sort of, have it be a very loose cousin of the trombone in some sort of demented sonic world. And it was important for me to have a song on the album because I feel it gives a human voice to the whole arc of the album. And so each piece is written individually, with the performers in mind. Long collaborations, like the piece for Miranda Cuxon, Secret Machine 7. We worked on that on and off for about 2 years. Of course, it was during COVID, so we had to sort of moderate how much we could meet up, and it was sort of spread out. But and similar with Between Breath, the title track, we had to do a lot of it through Zoom and all the other, methods people had to do for collaboration. But yeah, and so it ends up being this compilation, but it works as a kind of complete piece in and of itself. With the string music being the beginning and the end, I almost see it as kind of opening a portal that the listener is invited into that at the end, closes up and ho hopefully has made it through the journey, unscathed.
I'm still stuck on the pitch pipe thing. I'm waiting for a pitch pipe concerto from you. But Secret Machine number 7. Now that is obviously number 7 in a series of works of that title.
Yes, that's right. So Secret Machines are probably one of my oldest running series of serial, or not serial, but pieces that are in a series. Secret Machine 6 was completed in 2012. So it's been a while since I've written a so-called Secret Machine. The reason the Secret Machine series, all the Secret Machines are basically what you would call a process piece. Loosely, I'm using the term loosely. Process music is usually, Steve Reich and American minimalists are usually affiliated with that term. But what happens in the Secret Machine pieces is there's a process that's slowly revealing the music. And in the Secret Machine 7, the process is the range of the violin is revealed, slowly through different pizzicato notes in the violin, sort of activate a new zone of the violin. So by the beginning or by the end of the piece, you have the whole range of the violin being used, and there's a cyclic quality to the structure. And I think it has the sense of being almost like a machine in a sense, but it's very organic. And so I think it is kind of in between organic and inorganic, machine-like in the way something natural could almost be like a machine. And the secret part comes from my own convoluted process where I usually forget at some point in the composing process what my procedures are, or just they become intuitive and I don't really look back. So the the secret is to me, I don't really know how I wrote the piece once it's done. So, it remains a secret for forever. And I've even tried to find old sketches of the other secret machines, like, how did I write that? You know, like, what was I doing? And I still can't really decipher it. So, my cryptic sketches don't reveal the secret either. So maybe some smart future scholar can figure it out. But
Well, it's interesting because, like, your language with the solo violin in that piece is, it very much has a certain direction that it's going toward. These little gestures from the violin that sound like they're meant to be, you know. But I hear that music and it sounds different than anything else that I hear for the solo instrument.
Yes.
That is part of your secret process.
I like to think so. Writing for the violin, solo violin, it's one of the hardest instruments, I think, to compose for. There are so many bad pieces for solo violin. I feel so sorry for violinists and audience people who have had to sit through literally centuries of just bad solo violin music. And my favorite solo violin composer is Paganini. And I think why I like Paganini the most is it's kind of active. There's a lot going on. It's just very fascinating to listen to and watch a Paganini piece. And so when I was setting out to write for violin, I was like, well, Paganini is my model. I don't want it to be some sort of cheesy, you know, whatever 19th century, you know, nodding my head to the past or whatever. So I have a violin that I abused in a loving way, exploring different sounds and, really wanted to come up with a piece that sounded like no other piece I ever heard. And, there's some secrets going on that aren't so secret. Like the low G string is detuned to an E, a low E. So you end up with a tuning that goes from low to top. It's a E, D, A, E. And it almost sounds almost like a guitar. And when you tune a violin, that low string down to an E, you end up actually sort of in between a regular violin tuning and a viola tuning. And so I almost think of the Secret Machine 7's violin tuning as kind of uncanny violin because it's between violin and viola in its, you know, range capacity. And I really wanted something that sounded unique and totally new. And working with Miranda Cuxon was sort of the other secret to making this work is that she's super amazing. And when she asked for the piece, she said, this is in 2021. She's like, would you be interested to write me a piece, a solo piece? And I said, absolutely. Under the condition, I can write whatever I want and take as long as I want. And she pretty much said, oh, bring it on. Working with her was truly an honor of a lifetime. And there's no way the piece would have happened without her input and just relentlessly just being open to me showing up to her apartment with, you know, stacks of music saying, can you read through this really hard stuff that I'm probably not going to use? You know, so I think we arrived at something that's pretty unique. And but it took a lot of work. And I got to say, like, I feel like I've written a decent solo violin piece, and I think that will be the last one for a while.
Yeah. Well, speaking of violin, let's look at the first two tracks, parts one and parts two of, I'm going to try to pronounce this properly, Viola In, is that right?
Violaine.
Violaine. Okay, that's what I originally came up with. Then yes. I was reading some of the program notes about it originally being titled Viola and Violin.
Right.
Like, can you elucidate that for us?
Yeah. So originally the title of Violaine, the original title was very boring, Violin and Viola, you know, so Violin and Viola in the file name, in the computer file when I was engraving the piece. And I had a typo, you know, and it ended up saying Violaine, which is sort of this mashing the two words together. And I didn't even notice it at the time. And then when I went back to work on it, I said, oh, this piece is called Violaine, I guess. And I just thought it was a fun typo. And also the piece Violaine embraces sort of this typo aesthetic in that one, while I was writing it, which I write everything by hand. And when you transfer handwritten notation into a computer software program, you're bound to make mistakes. So some of those mistakes I made when I heard them in performance, I said, oh, actually that's more interesting than what I intended. And also with the performers, when we were doing different workshops, they would do something that was completely unexpected or, you know, quote unquote, a mistake. And I said, what is that? That's actually really interesting. And I started to see this sort of typo aesthetic or this mistake language is almost a way to generate material or generate a kind of form around that. And there's something also very poetic about embracing mistakes, you know, and I'm not the first musician to think this is a good idea. You know, I think there's some really good Keith Jarrett, you know, quotes about him talking about, you know, how he thinks of mistakes. And I don't know, just this idea of incorporating or embracing the mistake as sort of a blessing, as something you couldn't have come up with from your own internal, you know, inside your mind, but externally, the mistake is almost a revelation from God in a sense.
So you can have a pitch pipe violin suite, right?
Well, yeah, well, I should mention I have, you know, another, I have a violin duo that just was released last month. And the piece is for two violins and they both have pitch pipes and it's a 35-minute violin duo called Dead Horse Bay Thoughts from the Future. And so that one is very much a pitch pipe concerto. And, you know, so I have to be careful with these pitch pipes because, you know, it's now becoming my calling card. And, you know, my favorite pitch pipe manufacturer actually ran out of stock. And I don't know if it's from me, you know, ordering these and ruining them. And, you know, so, yeah, so yeah. I have a lot of pitch pipes here. My performers do, too. They're not the most sturdy instruments, I'll tell you that.
I sang in a boys' choir, and we always use pitch pipes, so that's why I'm focused on that right now.
Yeah, well, I'll write a piece for the boys' choir and pitch pipes.
There you go. You've talked a little bit about the title track, Between Breath. I wonder if you can tell us more about that. And specifically, what does the title mean for you? I mean, it's the name of the entire album.
Well, the title came from, well, one, you know, Between Breath, the piece was, it was very much written in lockdown. And I was really trying to make a sonic scream. Like I wanted to somehow depict the sort of internal scream I was feeling. And I think a lot of people were feeling, I wanted to sonorize the scream. And so the piece was very much about finding a way to sort of make this kind of angry scream into music and that then eventually becomes something other than just an angry scream. And the Between Breath title, I think there was so much emphasis at that time, we're talking 2021, 22, around breathing and people sort of being really aware of breath because there's a respiratory, you know, thing going around where, you know, we're all kind of hyper-focused on breathing in a certain way. And on top of that, breathing, you know, this relation to meditation or breath as being this life force thing. And in the sense with the music, it's, you know, the trombone uses breath. And so I was thinking about the nature of breath and, you know, the inhale, exhale sort of yin yang plus minus, you know, aspect to it, that binary aspect. But I wondered, what is the sort of liminal space that's in between the breathing, you know, the moment where you breathe out and you hold it or breathe in. And like, what is that? You know, the sort of third thing we don't, you know, you're either holding your breath or I guess, you know, blowing it out. But I thought of this idea of this liminal space. It's an imaginary idea. I don't think it's actually necessarily real, but this liminal space that's in between breath. And I just thought the Between Breath was a great title. I like the double B sound. And it just stuck. And I wanted to use that for the title track or the name of the album.
I love that in your program book, you have your parts of your score in
yes.
there, right?
Yes.
And it's really interesting to see that. I wonder who are your composition heroes? Because it makes me think of other contemporary composers.
Oh, interesting. Yes, that's a great question. My composition heroes, I'm very old-fashioned, and I think Ravel and Beethoven and Bach and Debussy are sort of my, like, great-great-grandfather heroes of who I really always come back to is, you know, if I was on a desert island, I mean, I'd take Bach with me and that I would be fine. But in terms of contemporary composers, you know, I'm always been a big fan of like Alex Minchek and Eric Wubbles, and they've actually run a new music collective called Wet Ink. And Eric Wubbles happens to have a trombone and piano piece that is truly remarkable, you know, like amazing piece of music. And I think in some way, when I heard trombone and piano, by the way, and I'm sorry for all the trombonists listening to this, but trombone and piano is sort of a lethally not good combination, in my opinion. It just sounds kind of, you know, corny when they're together and kind of cheesy. And it's really hard to find trombone and piano music that I can actually stomach. So, but Eric has this piece that's just so cool. And I was like, well, if I'm going to write for trombone and piano, I think Eric Webbles would have to be the model, because he's written literally one of the coolest pieces of music, and it happens to be with trombone and piano. So, I mean, those, you know, sort of the immediate heroes. And then I think you could also draw my musical background back to New York school composers like John Cage and Morton Feldman. And in some way, like Eric Satie is sort of a hero of mine too. I think the sort of enigma of Satie and the simplicity has really held up over time. And I think the older I get with composition, the more I'm really trying to make the most basic thing I can. And so Satie more and more is becoming a hero. He's always been a hero, but it's even stronger than maybe it has been before.
It's interesting that you say that, because I can sense some similarities between what you're doing with music and what Eric Satie did with music in the language of his time, right?
Yes.
So I can hear that definitely. Scott Wolschlager is the composer of all the music here on this album, Between Breath. It's out from New Focus Recordings. Do you have anything else that you want to say to our listeners as they prepare to dive into this album?
Well, you know, this is something I would say if it was a concert, my work is that, you know, to let yourself get lost, that's okay. And to be wandered, let your ears wander through the music. And I think it's completely acceptable if you space out for a second and come back. I think my music, I want to be very inviting with it. And I would just hope anyone hearing it just listens with an open mind and, you know, enjoys the ride, because this album is definitely a ride.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it. And checking in with you again, it's been a while since we talked last time, but I love your music, and this album is certainly no exception. Thank you
awesome.
Very much.
Thank you.